From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. C-SPAN goes against all of television's accepted rules. They use no sound bites, no editing, no commentary. They just let the cameras run uninterrupted, recording everything from proceedings in Congress to candidates on the campaign trail. On today's Fresh Air, we meet C-SPAN's creator, CEO, and on-air host, Brian Lamb. Also, we meet one of Britain's most uncompromising filmmakers, Ken Loach. He's not interested in neutrality. He wants his films to lead to social change. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews releases by Graham Haynes and the Ned Rothenberg Double Band, two electric jazz bands who he says succeed where others have failed. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Clinton is meeting with the Democratic members of the Armed Services Committee this evening. He's delayed his formal announcement on lifting the ban on gays in the military to give his administration more time to head off opposition in Congress. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
According to White House spokesman, President Clinton plans to unveil his policy tomorrow. Today, Secretary of Defense Aspin and Mr. Clinton himself consulted with lawmakers, including Senator Sam Nunn, the chairman of the Armed Services Committee and the most prominent opponent of the policy on Capitol Hill. This afternoon, Nunn made a speech on the Senate floor saying he would hold extensive hearings on the issue and calling for the matter to be resolved by consensus. Nunn refrained from repeating his earlier criticism of the way the White House had handled the issue. Congressional and White House officials say that the lifting of the ban, expected to be finalized after months of discussions with the military, will be coupled by a strict code of conduct. Republican lawmakers, led by Indiana Senator Dan Coats, say they'll try to turn the current ban on homosexuals into law, possibly attaching it to a popular piece of legislation like the family leave bill. At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
President Clinton is reportedly preparing to name a prominent gay advocate to be Assistant Secretary for Fair Housing and Equal Opportunity. The Associated Press quoted government officials as saying that the president intends to nominate Roberta Achtenberg. Achtenberg, who's 42, is a lawyer who currently serves on the San Francisco Board of Supervisors. The leaders of the Muslims and Croats in Bosnia have ordered an immediate end to all fighting between their forces. The announcement follows 2 weeks of fighting that threatened to undermine the Geneva peace talks on Bosnia. Bob Simpson reports for the BBC.
A spokesman read out a joint statement from Alija Izetbegović and Mate Boban, which said they had ordered the immediate cessation of all conflicts between Muslim and Croat forces within Bosnia-Herzegovina. It called for the support of all Muslims and Croats, saying that internal conflict only benefited the aggressors, meaning the Serbs. The factional leaders have also ordered that a joint army command be formed without hesitation and that those responsible for the fighting be identified. The Muslim delegation in Geneva earlier issued a letter sent to the co-chairman saying that if Serb aggression against Muslims continued, they would have to consider leaving the conference. They cited 6 instances of such aggression over the past couple of days and requested immediate action to create normal negotiating conditions by removing the threat of genocide and by preventing attacks on civilians by implementing the relevant UN resolution.
Bob Simpson reporting from Geneva. Stock prices were lower today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost nearly 8 points to close at 3,291. Declines led advances by a slight margin in heavy trading of 277 million shares. This is NPR. There's been new fighting reported in the southwest African nation of Angola, even as the leaders of the warring parties arrived in Ethiopia for peace talks. Thousands of people have been killed in fighting that broke out after the UNITA rebel faction refused to accept defeat in UN-monitored elections last year. UN Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali has threatened to pull the 700-member UN force out of Angola by April 30th if a ceasefire is not arranged. Cambodia's Khmer Rouge guerrillas allowed a UN deadline to pass today without registering their political party to take part in this spring's UN-supervised elections. UN officials say they'll try to keep a door open to the Khmer Rouge should they have a change of heart. Mary Kay Magstad reports from Bangkok.
The Khmer Rouge say the only way they'd run in this spring's elections is if they and the other two guerrilla factions are given a share of governing power beforehand, and if the hundreds of thousands of Vietnamese living in Cambodia leave the country. UN officials have said neither of these is likely to happen. Tomorrow in Beijing, UN officials and leaders of the four factions that signed the 15-month-old peace accord are to meet with Cambodian head of state Prince Norodom Sihanouk. There may be a last-ditch attempt to persuade the Khmer Rouge to join the election. Otherwise, the other three factions are expected to proceed on their own, setting a date for the polls and working out other details. The Khmer Rouge have hinted strongly that if the election goes ahead without them, they may intensify fighting in central and northwestern Cambodia and possibly even cause trouble in Phnom Penh. For National Public Radio, I'm Mary Kay Magstead in Bangkok.
Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin says his government will abide by the decision of the Israeli Supreme Court on whether or not it was legal to expel more than 400 Palestinians from the occupied territories. The justices are to announce their decision early tomorrow. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The guiding principle behind most TV is that viewers have short attention spans. But that principle doesn't guide the people at C-SPAN. They give us gavel-to-gavel coverage of our Congress and Senate, whether the sessions are lively or dull. C-SPAN also brings us hearings, debates, and symposia on public policy, roundtable discussions, and call-in shows. It's enabled us to watch our government at work, at its best and worst. C-SPAN doesn't have to worry about ratings. It's nonprofit, funded as a public service by America's cable companies. My guest Brian Lamb is the founder and CEO of C-SPAN, but C-SPAN viewers know him as a host who does interviews and takes listener calls. His mission is to bring us events in their entirety. No editing, no commentary. He even wants the camera to watch with a neutral eye.
We try very hard not to try to influence the audience with the way the camera angles are positioned or with the tightness of the shot. The best way to describe that, anybody that's ever watched 60 Minutes knows that they use special camera angles to help create a drama in the whole program. That's something that we would never do, at least we would knowingly never do it, because we want you to see the person or the individual exactly the way you would if you're sitting in a room with them. You wouldn't get up tight on their eyes or on their mouth. You would have a, you know, just a natural conversation. So if you go back to the conventions, you will, and you examined our coverage, there was a lot of effort made at not trying to artificially portray what was going on in the hall.
Let's talk a little bit about the creation of C-SPAN. You started proposing the idea of a cable network that would cover Congress back in 1977. Tell us how you got the initial idea for this.
Well, it was kind of an evolving thing. I came to Washington for the first time back in 1966 when I was in the United States Navy. And I was assigned to the Pentagon as a public affairs officer that literally every day dealt with requests from the commercial networks to cover different events. I mean, an example, at the time the Secretary of Defense was Robert McNamara, and if one of the networks wanted to interview him, they might call our department and I might get the call and I might have to, what they called it those days, staffing it. So I got very interesting exposure to how the whole system worked. And in 1966, I was 25 years old, and it was kind of my real, I mean, it's my first real education on how the system worked. The longer I was around it, the more I saw that a lot of what ended up on the evening news was not what happened that day.
Can you give me an example of something that you watched on the evening news and said, that's not what happened?
I'll give you a great example. And I was talking about this yesterday with somebody that was interested in this process at the office. And there was a correspondent by the name of Bill Downs, who's no longer alive. He used to work at CBS. He was in the Eric Severide group years ago. And then he eventually was hired by ABC, and he was assigned to the Pentagon. When I was there in 1966, Bill Downs was the Pentagon correspondent for ABC. That was right in the middle of the Vietnam War and the buildup in 66 and 67. And I remember a group of young people coming down from Volantown, Connecticut, about 40 of them, marching against the war, coming to the Pentagon. They were going to disrupt the war machine, and they marched on the Pentagon, and they were allowed to come in, and they camped out in front of the war room where the Joint Chiefs of Staff met And Bill Downs one afternoon, and I was assigned to be the, you know, the communications officer to go with him down to do his piece. And so he stood up in the middle of these young people. Up until that point, they had been lying on the floor, very peaceful, very pleasant human beings, had a strong message to deliver, and it was a pacifist message that the war was wrong. There's nothing wrong with any of that. That's part of our system. But the minute that the cameras rolled for ABC and that Bill Downs stood up, all of these young people stood up, took their placards, and started screaming, stop the war, stop the war. And so Bill Downs is shouting to the camera, you know, this is Bill Downs in the middle of all these young people outside the war room at the Pentagon for ABC News. There was nothing that the audience saw in that report that was an accurate account of how those young people had been operating. And that was one of many things that I saw when I was in the Pentagon that told me that there was just something a little bit askew here and that the audience ought to see the whole thing and make up their own mind as to what is right and what is wrong.
So all this manipulation that you were seeing of the press, manipulation by the press, led you to think that there needed to be a place on TV where events would be as they were, real, unedited.
Yeah, I would also add to that, and it kind of evolved again. My first try at this didn't work. The cable industry wasn't interested when the first pitch was made of having just another channel full of, you know, meet the press type programs. That was in the early days. CNN had not even been announced that it was going to happen, and there were only about four channels on the satellite. HBO was one of them. Channel 17 out of Atlanta was another. And it dawned on me at that point that maybe the industry might be interested in televising the U.S. House of Representatives, because the House had been discussing that possibility for about 6 years and never quite could make a decision. And so we married the two. The industry said, that's a good idea, let's do it, we can afford to do that. And the House of Representatives said, gee, that would be interesting if the audience could see it all. The nice thing about it was we were able to start by creating a television pipeline for our elected representatives in a democracy to be heard by their constituents. And that seemed to me that that's probably why we've been able to succeed, is that that was the right way to begin instead of just television in general and more programs like This Week with David Brinkley.
So when you first started televising Congress, and this was back in 1979, what were some of the debates in-house and the debates with Congress about how to televise it? Where should the cameras be? Who should control the cameras?
Well, one of the most disappointing aspects of our association with the Congress, I think, over the years has been that they have had such tight control over the cameras. It's probably as tight a control as any country in the world. It doesn't track with what our democracy is all about, and I've never quite understood why they were so concerned about the coverage. But the Speaker of the House has total control over who will be televised and you know, basically photographed at any one point. And there have been some controversies over that. As a matter of fact, Tip O'Neill years ago turned the cameras on the whole chamber to show during special orders that there wasn't anybody there. You know, if I had anything to say about it, and I do not, and I've never tried to have anything to say about it, I would, you know, we would put our own cameras in there and we would show the chambers reflecting exactly what's there during the time of day when they're actually having legislative debate. So we really stay away from the operation of the House and its television facility. That's their business. We try to tell the audience often enough so that they know that they're controlling the cameras, so they don't think that we're doing it. That will probably not change for a long time.
Why not? Don't you have enough clout now to say, listen, you guys, you really want to be on C-SPAN now. You've seen the effects it has. So now we're going to insist that we control the cameras.
We don't have enough clout, don't have any clout with them when it comes to that. And as a matter of fact, the only people that have clout, and this is probably the way it ought to be, is the people. And if the public at large gets mad enough about anything that they see in the Congress, they can have a major impact. And probably the most recent example of that was the Zoe Baird nomination.
What would you do differently if you were controlling how Congress was televised?
Well, if we were allowed to put our own cameras in there, we would just show the facility as it is, we would show reaction shots. The only people that are allowed to be shown on camera are those speaking. You know, in the British House of Commons, they think they have the toughest laws in the world about what can be seen. But one of the laws, one of the regulations in the British House of Commons is that they can show reaction shots. If somebody is addressing another member of the parliament, the camera can pick that other member up to see what kind of face they're making. You can't even do that in the House of Representatives. And what I think they ought to do, both in the House and the Senate, and again, they don't ask me, and they're not about to ask me, but if they ever did, is that they ought to show it as it is.
Now, did it take a longer time to convince the Senate? You didn't start broadcasting the Senate till 1986. Was that because of money or because they weren't interested?
Well, we didn't convince the Senate. The Senate convinced itself. And the way that worked was in 1981, when Howard Baker was majority leader, he put a piece of legislation into the hopper. It was, I believe it was Senate Resolution 20, if I can remember right, that would have opened the Senate to television. And for a lot of reasons, he was not successful during his tenure as majority leader in getting the Senate to go on television. Some people suspected that he was running for president and that that was his way of getting attention, through the cameras. But really what happened in the end was Senator Russell Long was one of the great opponents of televising the Senate, and so was Senator Robert Byrd. And back in about 1985 or so, Senator Byrd started to, and this is what he told me, he started to hear when he would go back home to West Virginia that people were confusing him with Speaker Tip O'Neill because they both had white hair and they saw Tip O'Neill on television a lot. And I think what really did it for Senator Byrd was the day he got introduced as this, you know, the Speaker of the House, Bob Byrd, at some function. At least that's what he told me. And he decided that if the Senate was going to be the institution that he thought it was, and that it was the world's most deliberative body and the world's most important debating organization, that the Senate better go on television. He convinced Senator Russell Long to step aside. He led the charge in the Senate, and when he did that and dropped his opposition, it was passed.
I know there was one story, and this goes back a few years, I think. You actually referred to this in an earlier answer, where the camera was on, I think, a Republican who was speaking after everybody else had gone home, basically.
Newt Gingrich.
Yeah, and whoever was running the camera pulled back and showed the empty seats. Can you actually tell us that story?
Sure. What happened was, this was back in the mid-'80s, and the Republicans, in the name of Congressman Newt Gingrich and Bob Walker and Dan Lundgren and I think Van Weber might have been there, although he didn't do much of that, would get on the floor of the House of Representatives after the legislative business was completed during what they call special orders, where any member can get an hour and say anything they want to say. And they were getting up day after day being very critical of the other side, naming people. Congressman Ed Bolin was one that they would name, and Tip O'Neill and others. And Tip O'Neill got tired of them speaking to an empty chamber and gesturing to the room as if there were people there. And he would say this. I don't say this. This is what he said, is that they would look over to the Democratic side of the aisle and act like there were people there and then say, it's your turn to come respond to what I'm saying about you, and no one would ever respond. So one day he literally ordered the cameras to swing to the chamber without any warning to the Republicans to show that there was no one in the chamber but Newt Gingrich at the microphone. Actually, I'm trying to remember whether it was Newt Gingrich or Bob Walker. I think Bob Walker was at the microphone because somebody came and slipped a note to him and said, they've just turned the cameras on this chamber and to show that there's nobody here. And that Tom Reed of the Washington Post was watching the whole thing, and he went to the typewriter and created what he called Cam Scam and made a big thing out of it. And for a lot of people in Washington, D.C., especially the Washington Post, this is the first time I ever heard of C-SPAN. This is about 5 years into our existence. And they made a big deal of it. It ran for days on the front page with pictures and everything else, calling this whole thing Cam Scam. And the speaker never backed down. They still show only, though, during special orders, that the chamber and who's in there. Unfortunately, they do not show during the actual meaty legislative business day who's in there and who isn't.
Does the majority party control the camera?
Yes. The Speaker of the House in the House of Representatives controls the camera, has absolute say-so over which direction they're pointed in. In the United States Senate, it's the Rules Committee, and the chairman of the Rules Committee is Wendell Ford.
Well, Brian Lamb, I think it's time to take a little break. So let me reintroduce you first. My guest is Brian Lamb, the founder of C-SPAN, and you also know him as a program host on C-SPAN. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Brian Lamb, you're the founder of C-SPAN and the CEO. How did you decide to put yourself on the air? You're one of the people who we often see on the air doing interviews or taking phone calls, doing continuity between broadcasts.
I was cheap.
Yeah.
I was real cheap. Still am cheap. In the early days, there were only, when I went on the air first, I think there were 7 people that worked at C-SPAN. I mean, we'd take a couple cameras up to the hill and cover a hearing in the daytime, run them back to the studio. Actually, it was one big office where I sat in and one of my helpers, Janet Dabrowski, sat in. We all sat in one room. We cleared the desks off at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. We fired up the cameras. We opened them up and took calls, telephone calls in 1980. October 7th was our first day from the audience on our business lines. So sometimes we get a call from somebody that wanted to do business with us during the middle of a call-in show, and they found themselves on the air talking to us about issues. So in those very early days, and frankly, the only people that were paying attention, because no one in Washington could see us in those early days, were just common, ordinary, down-to-earth folks out there that knew everything that was going on, loved the fact that they were there in the early days, and didn't have any pretense or worry about whether or not we were sophisticated.
So you put yourself on the air because you were cheap, you said. But I think your policy is basically not to hire on-air people, but to use people from behind the scenes.
We have about 7 people now that go on the air.
Mm-hmm.
All but 2 of them work full-time at C-SPAN. 2 of them do part-time work for us, fill in when we have problems. Everybody else has a major job. Susan Swain, who's on the air, is our senior vice president and co-chief operating officer. Bruce Collins is our general counsel. Lou Ketchum and Steve Scully and Kathy Buckley are producers. And I'm sure I'm leaving somebody out. Jim Gately and Ed Maddox are outsiders who come in and do these shows for us on an ad hoc basis. The philosophy is that we are not a personality-driven network, that somebody has to sit there and punch the buttons. As a matter of fact, we've toyed with the idea of putting 2 guests out there and letting them punch their own buttons and see what happens. It'd be a little bit difficult if you hadn't done it before, only because it's kind of intimidating with all the technology. But the objective is just to stay out of the way, that let people talk to the guests, let them hear what the guests have to say. It's not unlike what you do, except that on television, as you know, almost everything that is done has to be personality driven in order to keep those ratings high. Again, we have no requirement to have high ratings. And so we also want to make sure that our hosts, under no circumstances at any time, although this is very difficult to do, do not portray any kind of bias and just stay out of the way so that the public can make up their own mind about the guests and the callers can talk directly and form their own opinions. And, you know, by the way, sometimes we come off as extraordinarily dull. Understandably so, we know that, but again, that's part of our thing. that...
That's right. No, it's true. Listen, people... when people use the word dull in relation to C-SPAN, it's with some amount of praise, you know?
Well, it's... Yeah, and you do get tired of... You know, they dare to be dull, but it's an occupational hazard sometimes. Again, though, everybody needs to constantly look at who's paying the bills. And in our case, our industry's paying the bills through the good graces of our cable industry subscribers. They're not requiring us to deliver them eyeballs for advertisers, and that gives us an enormous amount of freedom. And because of that, we can be what we are, and we're not Pollyannas about this.
So I know one of the places you got your start on TV was doing a show called Dance Date, and this was, I think, when you were in college?
It was, and as a matter of fact, just to complete probably a childhood dream of mine, I met Dick Clark 2 weeks ago. The disgusting thing is he looks about 10 years younger than I do. And when I was growing up, I'm 51, when I was growing up, Dick Clark at WFIL in Philadelphia was the most important person in my life. I copied everything he did. I started my own little dance show in Lafayette, Indiana on Channel 18. I built the set, sold the time, hosted the program. And it was really one of the great learning experiences there's not a whole lot of difference between what I do today and what I did then. It's just a different topic of discussion.
Yeah, but it's very subjective to rate records, isn't it?
Yeah. What do you give this? A 95. I like the beat, you know?
Did you do that? Did you do those rate the record
we
things
did,
like Dick Clark?
As I said, Terry, I copied everything that Dick Clark, I think I even tried to sound like him, which is impossible. everything that he did, I tried to do.
So you played rock and roll?
Everything, yeah, rock and roll. Remember, we had one camera to do this show. It was a black and white. Gary Henderson, one of the engineers here at NPR, is looking because he knows what I'm talking about, a Vidicon camera, which meant that it wasn't very good. And the way that we had, the way that we were able to do this show was that we photographed on film a record running, on a turntable, and we made a continuous loop so that the director could push the button, and on the screen would come this record. You couldn't see what record it was running around on your screen so that they could move the camera back to show some of the kids dancing in a different position in the studio. So it was as basic an operation as you could ever imagine. So, and that's kind of the way C-SPAN was, I can tell you, in 1979.
Brian Lamb, I've got another blast from the past for you.
Uh-oh.
When you were a senior in high school, I think, you were runner-up in an announcing competition. I've never heard of such a thing.
Well, one of I had a wonderful high school broadcasting teacher by the name of Bill Fraser. He's still alive, very much so. He's 70 years old. He lives in Lafayette. And he, more than any other person, was responsible for teaching me all the little things that you have to learn in this business to get started. And he was the coach of the radio team. And we went to
radio
state.
Team?
Radio team.
What did the radio team do?
We went to the state, at regional and then state finals, and you had to announce. You had to read, names like Rimsky-Korsakov and pronounce them correctly. And it was a great disappointment for me. I wanted to win that contest more than anything because I thought radio was my medium, and I still love radio. Went to state at Indianapolis I came in second, but I lost by 1 point.
Brian Lamb, thank you so much for talking with us.
Terry Gross, thank you for inviting me.
Brian Lamb is the founder and CEO of C-SPAN, and you can also often see him on the air. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Jerry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, we talk with British filmmaker Ken Loach. He's been making movies about the working class, the homeless, and the jobless for over 30 years. And most of the movies were made for TV, where the people he was making movies about could also watch them. His new movie, Riff Raff, is about a construction worker from Glasgow who is also homeless. It'll be shown as part of a retrospective of Loach's work opening next month at Lincoln Center. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead tells us about two new releases that successfully merged jazz and world music. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. On Capitol Hill, Senate Republicans are preparing an amendment to write into law the current policy banning gays from the military. This move came as President Clinton postponed by one day his plans to issue an order lifting the ban. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
Congressmen are being deluged with phone calls. Leaders of veterans groups who want to keep the ban in place met with Senate Republicans. Gay and lesbian activists and feminists were also out in force, showing support for the president's expected move. Democratic Senator Howard Metzenbaum of Ohio said Mr. Clinton should disregard the wishes of some senators.
If President Truman had knuckled under to the will of the Senate 44 years ago, he never would have issued his famous order integrating the armed services.
Senate Republicans say they'll attach their amendment making the ban law to the first bill that comes their way. That probably will be the family leave bill, expected to reach the Senate floor early next week. This is Brian Naylor at the Capitol.
A new ceasefire had very little effect in either Croatia or Bosnia, as fighting continued in both places. In Croatia, Serbian forces advanced in both the south and the north, and in one case came to the edge of a UN truce line. UN peacekeepers were also detained in one town, partially under fire by Croatian troops. Muslim leaders in Bosnia called attacks on Sarajevo the heaviest in several months. They accused Serbian factions of shipping in new heavy weapons and said if these attacks continued, they would consider leaving peace talks in Geneva. Democratic Congressman Ron Dellums is the new chairman of the House Armed Services Committee. He takes the job after 22 years in Congress as an opponent of U.S. military intervention overseas. NPR's John Greenberg has more on the story.
At a news conference today, Dellums acknowledged that some people would be dismayed with his election to the chairmanship. During the defense buildup in the 1980s, Dellums consistently opposed the MX missile, the B-1 and B-2 bombers, and other weapons. He tried to allay concerns that his views will dominate the committee and promised to make sure that those with different opinions have a chance to be heard.
I am not afraid of openness and fairness and open discussion and open debate. You show me a person who is afraid of open discussion and open debate, and I'll show you a person who does not have the ability to articulate their perspective and their point of view.
Dellums favors deeper cuts in defense than President Clinton offered during the campaign. He also advocates increased spending to move the defense industry into civilian research and manufacturing. This is John Greenberg in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down nearly 8 points to close at 3,291.39 on volume of 277 million shares. This is NPR News. President Clinton says as of yet he's not sure if he can meet his goal of cutting the federal deficit by $145 million without raising taxes. Mr. Clinton says by the time he outlines his economic plan to Congress next month, he should have an answer. Treasury Secretary Lloyd Bentsen has raised the possibility of an energy consumption tax. The president met this morning at the White House with leaders of congressional financial committees. During the current campaign that just ended, Clinton promised to cut the deficit in half in 4 years. Since that time, the national debt has increased to an estimated $327 billion. A study in tomorrow's New England Journal of Medicine suggests that one person in three uses unconventional medical therapies each year. David Barron of member station WBUR reports.
Americans are using acupuncture, chiropractic care, hypnosis, commercial weight loss programs, and other unorthodox treatments far more often than many doctors have suspected, according to the survey of 1,500 people. The researchers estimate that 60 million American adults each year seek out such care, most commonly for back pain, allergies, and arthritis. In the process, they spend over $10 billion. Dr. David Eisenberg of Boston's Beth Israel Hospital headed the research team.
The highest users are people in the 25 to 49-year-old age bracket who tended to live on the West Coast, which was not a big surprise.
Eisenberg says far more research is needed to determine if the popular alternative therapies actually work. For National Public Radio, I'm David Barron in Boston.
Four airlines in Europe are meeting about the possibility of working together in the light of deregulated air travel there. The four Austrian Airlines, KLM, Swissair, and SAS. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Next week, the Film Society of Lincoln Center will present a retrospective on the work of British director Ken Loach. Loach is considered one of England's most uncompromising film directors. He makes films with the hope that they will encourage debate and lead to social change. He started off making documentaries in the 60s and then turned to fiction film, in which he tried to deal realistically with the working class, the unemployed, the disenfranchised, and the homeless. His recent thriller, Hidden Agenda, was about British violations of civil liberties in Northern Ireland. It won a special jury prize at the Cannes Film Festival. His latest film, Riff Raff, is about construction workers. The film opens in many American cities next month. I saw an advance video copy, and it was subtitled, which was helpful because even though everyone is speaking English, their thick accents were hard for me to understand. I wanted to know if the film will be subtitled in theaters.
Yes, it's subtitled in America, and I think they also use that in Australia. I mean, it's a film about working people, and if you're accurate about how they are, then it can be a problem understanding them in another country. I mean, we have the same thing with American films.
Are they ever subtitled in England?
No, because you're the center of the empire, you see.
yes, we knew that.
you take your language abroad and people have to put up with it. But for we colonists, we have to make it acceptable.
So there's something very disorienting about watching an English language film but having to read subtitles to make out what's being said.
Yeah. I mean, do you need them all the time or do you just refer to them now and then?
I got used to it, so I ended up referring to them a lot, although there's times when I didn't need them. Mm. But there really was a lot that would have been lost on me. Now, part of that was that it was on video. Mm. And, you know, the sound on video is never as good as the sound in a theater.
Right.
Did you know that you would subtitle it when you were making it for, you know, in America?
No. It came up when it was shown at the Toronto Film Festival. But no, it was a decision taken then. And we found that actually, the subtitles helped in that they would crystallize a gag, for example, and the audience would laugh at the punchline when they read it. And so that it actually helped, and it took off the strain of having to listen very hard. And it sort of seemed to support the film when it was shown to that audience. So I didn't mind too much.
Now, the main character in Riff Raff is homeless, and he moves into a squat, into an unoccupied apartment. Are lots of people having to do that in England now?
There's a lot of people are homeless, particularly single people. If you go to London, you see them in cardboard boxes. It's a major problem, and it's something which has increased dramatically in the last decade. The point of Stevie is that he's a building worker. I mean, he has the power with others to actually make homes. And a lot of building workers are out of work. So we've got people in cardboard boxes, and building workers sitting on their bottoms, and that's the absurdity of the mess we're in.
What are some of the ways you've seen England change since you started making movies about England?
Oh, it's changed a lot, and largely got worse. I mean, the biggest change has been over the last decade, and the ravages of the Thatcher regime, where, I mean, really, when we started in the 60s, by and large, people expected to work, and we did a film called Kes about a boy who's got a very imaginative side to him, but the odds are he'll go into a fairly routine job. And the point of the film was to say this kid has a lot of richness in his imaginative life, but that'll never be reflected in what he's able to do. But the point now is that people are just face a lifetime of unemployment or very sporadic employment. I mean, we went from a few hundred thousand people out of work to 3 to 4 million, and that's been constant for the last 10 years. So it's a much impoverished, culturally impoverished place now, and a sense of despair and defeat and pessimism is rife, and that's the legacy of our wretched government.
My guest is British film director Ken Loach. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. Back with film director Ken Loach. You started working with the BBC. Was that a good place to get started with your type of filmmaking?
Yeah. I mean, we couldn't have made the films anywhere else apart from television.
Because the film industry wasn't doing very well.
Yes, and also because the television, as you know, is voracious, and it demands a lot of films or programs. And so I mean, the group I was with were turning out a program every week, and 1 year I made six. Started off as plays, and actually became films by the end of the year. We were making films, and to have to turn out that amount of work quickly, I mean, you really, it's a very privileged position because you learn as you're doing it.
Is the BBC still a good place for filmmakers?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, it doesn't have the sort of same freewheeling confidence that it had when I started. I mean, it's much more nervous now and much more constrained, I think. I haven't worked there for some time, but that's my impression from seeing what they're doing and also talking to the people who are there.
Your new film, Riff Raff, has gotten funding from England's Channel 4. How would you describe Channel 4?
Channel 4, when it began, was supposed to be a channel that would, first of all, work with independent producers and production companies, and secondly, promote what they called an alternative way of looking at the world, or an alternative to the mainstream films, and they would take a different point of view. I mean, that hasn't worked out. Altogether, it's subject to the same constraints as the other commercial channel. And in fact, I, you know, along with many other people, suffered considerable censorship at their hands in documentaries.
What kind of censorship?
Four programmes made in the early 80s as a critique of trade union leadership from the left, saying why hadn't they fought, organised and fought this the rise in unemployment? Why hadn't they mobilize the resistance that was there to make a political attack on the government, to actually defend people's jobs, defend people's working conditions. They didn't do that for various reasons, and the programs were an exploration of that. They were stopped, but after a campaign by a couple of union leaders who we criticised. And that was just after Channel 4 had started, so that was a fairly early lesson in the realpolitik of television broadcasting. But in other respects, they've been very bold. They've had a go, and they've been very good for fiction. I mean, without them, there really would be no British film industry at all, because they've allowed films to be made, which they then wouldn't show on television for a period. So you could put it in the cinema, and it could have a cinematic life, and that was very important.
The film that you made before Riff Raff was called Hidden Agenda, and that was about a pair of human rights workers from America who go to Northern Ireland, at, you know, looking for human rights abuses. And one of them is meeting with a member of the IRA, and they're both shot down by British security forces, and the government creates a story to cover the murders up. What was it like for you to shoot in Northern Ireland?
We couldn't get insurance to shoot in Belfast for the whole film, so we had to shoot some of it in London. But we went as a documentary crew, and of which there are quite a few there, and we went as a fairly small crew and tried to shoot as unobtrusively as we could. The point of the film was to tell a story which wasn't being told, which is that the British presence in Ireland is very corrupting. It's a very dirty war. And that the corrupting influence spreads into the British politics of the rest of the United Kingdom, and it's an untold, the whole business of what's going on in Ireland is an untold story.
Did you feel that film was the victim of censorship?
The British are very sophisticated about these things. No, I can't point and say this film is censored, because it wasn't. But what happened was that when it before it had opened, a right-wing MP said that it was an IRA propaganda film. So it was he said it was the IRA entry to Cannes. Well, of course, it wasn't. It doesn't deal with the IRA as such. But it got tagged that, so that a lot of cinemas then, when it came to showing it in Britain, thought of it as the IRA film and said, well, we can live without this. You know, we don't really want to show that. It was the time of the Gulf War, and we don't want to show something which attacks Britain. And so they wouldn't show it. I mean, it did quite well everywhere else, but the sort of smear stuck.
When one of the main characters, played by Brad Dourif, the human rights worker, is in Northern Ireland, there's a parade going by the window of the room that he's in. And he looks out the window and he sees that there are a lot of British soldiers looking through their guns as the parade goes by. And he finds that experience just really unnerving. You could tell it just kind of sends a chill down his spine. Did you have that reaction yourself?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think it comes as a shock to anybody who goes to the north of Ireland and to city like Belfast and sees the British Army on the streets using their guns as telescopes, looking to the telescopic sights to see what's going on. And you see the soldiers in shopping areas and where there's small children, and keeps seeing the gun being raised to their eyes. It certainly shocked Fran McDormand and Brad and Mies Etling and the French actor who was there, the four members of the team who went and did what a human rights group would do, and took statements from people of their accusations of brutality and the rest. And It is a very shocking place. I mean, you don't really expect to go to a city that's supposed to be in the United Kingdom and be at the wrong end of a rifle, do you?
Now, someone whose career parallels yours in a way is Stephen Frears. He was making films that were shown on the BBC for many years, but he's kind of crossed over to Hollywood. He directed My Beautiful Laundrette, and directed the more Hollywood film Dangerous Liaisons, and directed Hero more recently. Is that something you would like to happen to you?
Well, I think it's very difficult to work where you're basically a tourist, is my problem. I mean, I think it's, you know, I come here, I don't really understand the nuances of what's happening. I see what happened as a tourist. In Britain, I think I've some sense of what things mean, of the subtleties of the exchanges that are happening, and you know the appropriate words to say and the resonances they have. I think it's very difficult to work outside the area where your intuition operates. The other problem is that there are examples of directors who have come from Europe and worked in Hollywood, and they end up becoming American directors. It seems that what made them good in their own country gets lost under the pressure of the industrial process. And, you know, I'm not sure I'd be able to withstand that, in fact, because a lot of probably more eminent people than I have signally failed, it seems to me.
Ken Loach, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Okay, thank you. It's been really enjoyable. Thanks a lot.
Ken Loach's new film, Riff Raff, opens in many cities next month. A retrospective of his work begins next week at Lincoln Center in New York. This is Fresh Air. Congress is talking about the ban on gays in the military. Let's see how they're covering that on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry. We'll have a report from Brian Naylor today about many speeches made in Congress, one of them by Senator Sam Nunn, very influential chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, who says that he'll hold hearings on this subject, I believe in March. Opposition, though, there is strong to President Clinton's promise to lift the ban on gays in the military. We'll hear from a veteran who's been calling up Congress to say why he thinks they should not lift the ban, and from a gay veteran on why it's important that the ban be lifted. Also, news of Virginia Governor Wilder's plan to limit gun purchases to one a month.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says most meetings between jazz and so-called world music have been a bust, reducing both traditions to their lowest common denominator. But Kevin says two new albums of electric jazz are on the right track.
Jazz musicians are usually eager, if not always ready, to absorb new rhythms. It took a lot of them 10 years before they could play a passable reggae beat. Electric jazz has been especially hard up for alternatives to caveman rock beats or complicated funk vamps that don't swing. But two new albums that look to West Africa and North Africa for inspiration find different ways out of the old rhythmic ruts. Cornet player Graham Haynes' CD, Nocturne Parisian, is on the Muse label. Graham Haynes comes from New York, but he'd moved to Paris to assemble the band of West African, American, and European musicians on his new album. Haynes says he got interested in complex cross rhythms through his father, the great jazz drummer Roy Haynes, and that he wanted musicians who could play polyrhythms without reading them off of sheet music. Like a lot of other jazz composers, Haynes is convinced learning music by ear helps it come alive. By letting his players find their own ways into the web-like rhythms, everything breathes more freely. The bubbling percussion and the drone of an Indian tambora make a nice setting for his cornet, too. As you can hear, he's a Miles Davis fan. To be honest, Graham Haynes' band concept is still developing. Some tracks on his CD sound more like sketches than finished pieces, and his keyboard player is way too fond of sampled voices and strings. Haynes is still sorting out what works and what doesn't. By contrast, saxophonist and composer Ned Rothenberg has been leading his double band for a few years, and their focus is razor sharp. Their debut CD on the Moores Music label is called Overlays. The six-piece double band is really two mirror image trios of alto sax, electric bass, and percussion. Sometimes the trios play similar phrases, but in different rhythmic cycles. That's sort of how West African drum choirs work. The trio may start out playing in sync, then one group will shift out of phase with the other, setting up elaborate syncopations, some written and some improvised. Ned Rothenberg is a serious student of world musics, and his double band's fluid rhythms owe a lot to the Rai music of Morocco. The blurry doubling of parts recalls trance-like Moroccan jajouka music, too. It's a smart mix, but in a sense, Rothenberg's just doing what smart musicians often do, appropriating good ideas from other players or genres without trying to copy their sound.
Kevin Whitehead is a jazz critic and record annotator in New York. He reviewed Nocturne Parisienne by Graham Haynes and Overlays by Ned Rothenberg and his double band. Fresh Air was produced today by Fred Lander. All our engineers this week are Audrey Voblaitis and Joyce Lieberman. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Dr. Jerome Groopman about working with AIDS patients at Deaconess Hospital in Boston, where he runs an innovative program of both treatment and research. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.